So I'll just be offering some sort of obviously personal reflections on my sort of life in the order, living in the order. A little bit of background. I was ordained 2008. I was ordained by Sada Loka. I asked for ordination in, I think it was 99 or 98. And I just sort of noticed preparing this talk today, thinking about Sada Loka ordaining me, that he didn't have to ordain me. I was reflecting on my time in the cooler period with Stiramani, that Stiramani, myself and Sada Loka spent sort of 2 weeks together at Gukyaloka. And I just sort of thought he didn't have to ordain me. You know, as in he wasn't being paid to do it, you know, he didn't have to sort of do that. And I was also thinking that, oh, I don't know, the effort that all my friends put into helping me move towards ordination and the ordination team here. Funnily enough, this is the same ordination team I'm on that helped me get ordained, which I just have to try and not think about sometimes because it weirds me out. So what I'll talk about is, I thought I'd talk about, as I'm more recently ordained than the other two chaps, what sort of changed with ordination. So what changed before ordination and what changed after ordination in my sort of life in the order, in a way. So obviously there are some things that really do change with ordination, and it's good to be aware of those. There's some things that just won't change with ordination, and so it's good to sort of have a bit of a sense of what might change and what might not. So I'll talk about what didn't change first, so that you're under no false pretenses in the ordination process. So after arriving back from the sort of mystery of this 4 month course at Gukyaloka, and when I sort of got my feet back on the ground and my head wasn't quite spinning from being back in the middle of the city in Nottingham, I realised quite quickly, which I sort of guessed this anyway, that my samskaras, my deep sort of unskillful patterns of behaviour hadn't budged at all. They were waiting. You know, they were waiting for me with open mouth and sharp teeth when I got back to Nottingham. Even before that, I'm sure. These unskillful patterns of behaviour obviously began to emerge quite quickly as I sort of started my life in the order. I'll just give you a little story of, this was actually right after my private ordination, so maybe it doesn't, obviously you're not fully ordained until the public ordination, that's when you're fully ordained. But just as a bit of an illustration of, you know, so you don't think that, oh, when you get to Gukyaloka and get ordained, things will just, your life will just be dramatically different. So straight after my private ordination, I remember Sada Loka had privately ordained me, and it was the next day, so I hadn't been ordained 24 hours at this point, and we had a bit of a free day, and I was walking by myself trying to absorb this quite strange experience of the private ordination, and I had a stick with me, and I was trying to, cutting a long story short, I was trying to take a shortcut on a walk I was on. I was sort of exploring, and I thought, well, I'll follow this path that will give me a shortcut across these terraces and back to where I need to get to. And if any of you have been to Gukyaloka, you'll see that it's very difficult to differentiate between footpaths and animal tracks. Mm-hmm. So the footpaths will take you where you want to go. The animal tracks will finish in bushes. So you'll kind of think, I'm on a path. And you'll just get to a bush, and you can see that the little rodent's gone underneath, and I'm not a little rodent, and I can't get under that bush. So this kept happening, and I was getting a little bit more annoyed, and I was probably just a bit freaked out by this whole ordination thing and the pressure of it or something. And I finally got to this bush, and I just lost it. It's like I'd got lost so many times. And I think I got to this kind of, you know, the final little path that I thought I was going to be able to get out, got stuck again, got my kind of shorts caught on this bush, and I just lost it, and I went mental, and I started thrashing this bush that was in the way. I was just so annoyed, and there was a pressure And I was just thrashing this bush and swearing to myself. I didn't want to shout it out. I don't know if any of you have seen the Fawlty Towers scene where John Cleese starts shouting at the mini. He goes, right, you asked for it. And he runs off and gets a branch and he comes back. That was just what sort of happened. So but that was just a little bit of a sort of, I just thought it was quite a good example in a way of, you know, what does change and what doesn't change. So I got this new name. I was given the mantra for my sadhana and I was quite focused. And, you know, 5 minutes later, I'm thrashing this bush and just sort of losing it. Okay. So when I got back, as Padma Vajra mentioned, when I got back to Nottingham, I was quite involved in running the Nottingham Buddhist Centre. And again, so just to remind you, I'm on the sort of theme of what doesn't change and that these deep habits sort of don't change with ordination. So to see me at the Buddhist Centre there, it also wasn't that long before I became the Mitta convener in Nottingham under the very good sort of guidance of my friend Jinnah Raja. So to see me doing a class, I'd be up front, I'd be sort of communicating. And I probably looked like, you know, from where you were sitting, if you were on a beginner's course or a regular's course, I probably looked like a very good order member. If you'd see me around that time on holiday with my girlfriend in North Wales camping, there was a moment where I just lost it on this holiday again. And I started kicking this car, kicking our car, her car, in the car park. I started kicking the car in the car park, threw my coat on the ground and was storming up and down, like having a sort of childish tantrum. And, you know, in a few days' time, I would have been back at the Buddhist Centre saying, it's very good to try and be patient in our responses to that. So the bottom line is, being ordained doesn't cure you. Your samskaras, your bad habits will be there waiting for you when you get back. They'll be waiting for you in the order. So, yeah, it's good to sort of have a sense that in pursuing ordination that you're, obviously our motives are going to be mixed, but, yeah, don't think that when you get ordained, you know, you'll be all cured. Or the order members are perfect. I'm sure most of you have realised that they're not by now, hopefully. If you haven't, you will. So just to talk personally about what did change. I sort of noticed that my ability to engage with these deeper samskaras and habits did change. So the habits themselves didn't change, but my ability to deal with them did. Once you have an effective practice, all you need to do in a way is actually make the decision to engage with these habits and stuff. I remember before ordination, I was, you know, would be much more confused as to how to engage with these sort of deeper tendencies. But after ordination, having a definite sense of how I was able, once I'd made the decision, because you don't have to make the decision, once I had made the decision to make inroads into these habits, that progress could definitely be made. I was in a much more reliable position to be able to work with these sort of habits and samskaras. So I suppose an effective practice, an effective going for refuge practice is a practice where, you know, there's nothing getting in the way of you engaging with these things. I'll come back to this later. I particularly found that I could engage much more deeply with Bhante's whole system of practice. So you taught the system of meditation very clearly at Gukhyaloka. And you also begin to have a sense of the system of practice. But I think when I got back, and particularly, it seemed to be made particularly clear for me with the seven papers, and particularly Subhuti's talks here on the system of Dharma life, I had a very clear, really clear sense of how to live and work as an order member, by just implementing the different sections of the you know, the system of the Dharma life, of just, sure, you know, integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and dharmic receptivity. So I felt in a really good position after ordination to work with all this, to work with this stuff, which I'm still, and all order members are still, you know, will be doing that now, if that makes sense. So I'll talk a little bit about what did and didn't change on sort of a more collective level. I will talk about some positive stuff soon. So. But getting back to sort of Nottingham, there was a schism in the Sangha in Nottingham for about 10 years. There was a rift in the Sangha. So this was characterised by polarisation, very poor communication between order members, very negative caricatures of people that within this polarisation. People in the situation, including myself, really didn't see each other. Most of the Sangha attending, the majority of the Sangha attending the Buddhist Centre weren't aware of this, thankfully. Some people might have been there. I was sort of, particularly after ordination, I was sort of more and more involved, unfortunately, in this sort of polarisation. Because my friend Jinawaja was fairly sort of central to it, unfortunately. So it's very painful for everyone involved. But it was really good to sort of remember what Subhuti said in these talks, that the order is effective, it's not real. And it's very important to get a sense that the order, I mean, I've already mentioned it, the order isn't perfect. And that it's really sort of up to each individual order member to really take responsibility, to try and remain in harmony with other order members, with members of the Sangha, and to remain in good communication. Sometimes, of course, things just go wrong. Things just get difficult, as they do in any sort of human communication. And I think that, just to say sort of in, so without, I mean, that was quite difficult coming back. My first few years in the order were only partly, characterised by quite a schism in the Sangha, and characterised by my very close dear friend, Jinawaja, very sort of centrally involved in these sort of difficulties. And some people, I think, sort of felt that the rest of the order had sort of let them down in this situation on both parts of this sort of polarity. But I never particularly felt that myself, that anyone had been let down, because I kind of thought, well, what more could be done? What could be done? There's no crack force in the order to come and deal with disharmony and just sort everything out. There's only human beings in the order, and I sort of definitely had a clear sort of sense of that when I was back and when I was ordained. Interestingly enough, my sort of I'm not trying to do a big sob story here. Mm-hmm. I just want to clearly put that out. But this, at the same time, this is, you know, part of sort of my early experience in the order. With my welcome back from Gukyaloka event in Nottingham, I was the only order member present at it. So, you know, that wasn't that easy in a way. But it's good to be realistic about the endless possibilities for conflict and the endless possibilities for harmony in human communication and within the order. I think Nottingham was a little bit of a special situation, so to speak. There's not been that many situations like that, or there's been probably a very small handful where disharmony sort of carries on for so long. Just to say, I'm going to talk about harmony in a short while, but there is more harmony in the order than there is disharmony. But that was certainly I certainly quite quickly sort of felt that side of things in the order. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about on a more positive note, how my sort of individual practice, so to speak, has been affected by the order on a more collective level, if that makes sense. Hopefully it will do. So I think since ordination, I felt that my personal practice has been really, really clearly guided by the rest of the order. And I've been very, very happy to sort of let that happen in a way. I'll give a little bit of an example. So a few years after I got back from Gukyaloka, again in quite a good sort of state of mind and engaging with the system of practice, going on solitary and on a meditation retreat and a solitary that happened afterwards, there's a reason I'm talking about my meditation experiences here, which you'll find out in a sec. My meditation really started sort of opening up. And I started having lots of experiences and things like that. And what happened, this was particularly on solitary, my meditation experience really started opening up. And I felt like I was making very strong inroads at the time into the Dharma in a way. But what happened very quickly was I thought, this is it. This is the real deal. I'm the man. I thought, gosh, I'm really making progress now. I had a sense that, oh, this is the real work, what I'm engaging with in meditation here, what kept unfolding, this is the real work. This is, directly seeing into the insubstantial nature of mind. But what happened is that I very quickly, so that was a fruit of practice, was a fruit of being in the order. But what happened very quickly is I started feeling quite self-important about what was arising in my practice very quickly. This manifested by my awareness that I couldn't talk in the chapter with my other, there was just three of us in the chapter. And I felt that I couldn't talk with the other two guys in the chapter about this because they hadn't had these experiences that I'd had, which was a real problem on lots of different levels. It was firstly a problem because in a way, I sort of felt I was special. I wasn't going to mention this, but it was my girlfriend, Kushala Devi, I told myself I wasn't going to mention this, but I am, who said when I was talking to her about, the emptiness of self and stuff, she said, whenever you talk about this, there's a sort of, I'm just seeing self-infatuation. I was so annoyed about it. I was so fed up. I was like, she doesn't understand me either. And it wasn't long before I thought, at the time I even thought, she's on to you. And but I particularly sort of felt it, in the chapter, I felt a little bit special. I have this sense of, I've seen something that these guys haven't seen. I'm sure they noticed it as well, I hope they did. But the thing is, thankfully, by being in the order and by immersing myself in the institutions of the order, in the sort of, as Subhuti talks about in the talks here, by immersing myself in the field of Kalyan and Mitrata, that this self-importance and this sort of clinging to these experiences in meditation and this expanded and inflated self-view began to change, and I began to realise that these experiences actually didn't amount to anything, amounted to very little. So it was through my engagement with the order and my engagement with spiritual friendship that I thankfully was able to see that. I'll give you a little example. My precept, my beautiful preceptor, Sardaloka, said to me, he was onto me straight away as well, when I mentioned this sort of not self stuff, he went, not self means not selfish. He wasn't having any of it, and he just bashed me right in the face with that. And I kind of, but again, I just thought, he's got a point. It was interesting whilst having these experiences, I was still feeling resistance to, it's not like I would start doing the dishes more or I would start going out to people more. I was more kind of going, I'm special. This is interesting, there's no self here. So I'm not being critical about the whole no self thing as well, but I'm just talking about this was what happened. This was my sort of experience. But I realised as well while supporting and going for refuge retreat here at Padmaloka that what was most important was it was a going for refuge retreat with Satyaraja was leading it on the system of Dharma life a few years ago. I realised that, he was leading the group I was in. I realised that what was most important wasn't these experiences and wasn't me and my no self. what was most important was to be able to immerse myself in Bhante's vision of the order. That was all I could do. With anything that arises, any progress that's made, all you do is immerse yourself in Bhante's vision of the order, Bhante's vision of sort of helping others and deepening your practice. To immerse oneself in the order as a manifestation of the imagery of the thousand-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara. I thought it did. These experiences just don't matter. It's not changing my behaviour. I could sit twiddling my thumb in my rooms having these experiences. It's not affecting anyone else. So it's a bit, I felt personally, it was a dead end. And I felt that the order had, I know it sounds a bit dramatic and I don't mean to be dramatic, but the order had sort of saved me on a certain level from this dead end, because that's what I felt for me it was at the time. And I felt, in a way, I feel still very positively contained and sort of channeled by the rest of the order in my practice constantly on a day-to-day level. That's what, particularly here at Padmaloka, actually, that's what I feel. I feel that as an order member, as long as I do what Bhante thinks is helpful and what his disciples and my Kalyana Mitras think is helpful and skillful, that I can't go wrong. As long as I keep doing that, keep engaging in that way. And I was thinking this afternoon, I feel as though there's a sort of strange invisible road is constantly sort of laid, invisible road, what the hell's that? That was the image that came up. But it's constantly sort of laid out before us in a way. And that as long as I keep in contact with other order members that I trust and respect, that this journey towards deepening going for refuge will unfold in the right way, as long as I'm in contact with my good friendship, the institutions of the order and movement, and particularly keeping in connection with Bhante's sort of vision of the order. Obviously, the living out of that. It's not quite as sort of straightforward as that in a way. And it's, as Subhuti said in the talks on the system of Dharma life, that the devil is in the detail. And it does also take critical and sort of receptive awareness, amongst other things, to sort of follow this invisible road. Ask me about what I'm talking about later or something. That's how a genuine sort of... I suppose what I'm trying to say is I just feel contained by the rest of the order. And I do, and I know this is a big thing to say, I do feel that, I kind of feel at the moment in the order with my friends, the people I know, that I sort of can't go wrong as long as I keep to Bhante's system of practice and everything that Bhante sort of unfolded. I really feel in my heart that I sort of can't go wrong. I know that sounds like a sort of big thing to say, but that's my response. So I'll just finish by I'm sure I'm missing a page. By talking about what's been the most important thing to me in my order life so far, and what's been most important is an engagement in the collective work of the order, the living with other order members, both in the community in Nottingham and the last 14 months here, and working on a common vision, common project together with other order members. Yeah, firstly in Nottingham with Arthur Bandu and Ginu Arjuna, more recently here. So this has been the most important thing, this working in this collective project, this collective vision. And it seems that in this regard, the more I work with other order members on this common project of seeing into the nature of reality and helping others to do the same, the more I see that the work of the order is more important than my personal practice, if that makes sense. In a way, personal practice and collective work more and more in my sort of life seem to be inseparable. You know, when I do sort of, yeah, when I engage in my meditation or my, in the threefold path, however that is, that does feel inseparable from the order's engagement in that. I hope this is clear. Perhaps it's not. But yeah, I really have a sense that my personal practice and the collective practice of the order just do seem more and more inseparable. I suppose I particularly noticed that working here on the ordination team. But if I think back to Nottingham, I definitely felt it there as well. And when I came to support going for refuge retreats, when I would come on Mitra Conveners meetings and not here, I would, and leading men's events, to really have a clear sense that I'm part of something much bigger here. And I just feel so grateful to Bandu for setting up the order in the way that he has done. It feels almost remarkable and kind of, it just feels remarkable and sort of very strange how my personal vision seems inseparable from the vision of my brothers that I'm working with. I don't know if this is doubt or what, but I just sometimes think, how the hell has that happened? How is my personal vision deeply connected, it seems, with the vision of the other order members that I'm surrounded by? It seems so mysterious. I can't really sort of understand it. And I think that's partly the part of the order in a way that seems very mysterious and seems quite sort of that one can't quite understand. I suppose I'm talking a little bit about what Subhuti's talking about in a super personal force. And again, I know this sounds sort of, I'm not making any grand statements here, but there's something I find really mysterious about working with others in the order. On my recent solitary, I was connecting with the inseparability of my desire for happiness and other people's desire for happiness. I felt quite at points, certainly not continually by any means. At brief points, I felt a connection in meditation that my desire for happiness is no different from others' desire for happiness. And I just feel very blessed that I can live in a life where I'm working with others that are following a similar vision in a way, and trying collectively to help others to go for refuge. And it's quite strange. So having this connection with, you know, trying to connect more and more that, to see the importance of that, my desire for happiness is exactly the same as others. I suppose the mystery of that is that on the one hand, I'm completely selfish, and it seems that most of the time I'm only concerned with my own needs. And yet there's something else present that's been growing since ordination that seems to be in opposition to these sort of more egoistic forces, as Subhuti would put it. And it feels more and more that a significant part of me needs to be in an environment where I'm working with others in this way. Yeah, I mean, I'll finish there. Just finally, I also just have felt incredibly lucky in my, I suppose, brief order life that I've had such good friends in the order. I think that's the main thing. I just wouldn't, in actually all of my sort of Dharma life, I used to think I'd come to the Dharma for the Dharma, and when I went to the Buddhist centre, I thought I was staying there for the Dharma because I had a connection with the Dharma. Actually, that was nonsense. It was because I was engaging with the order members there and friends there. They were the people that kept me there, not my personal connection with the Dharma. I could have gone to another Buddhist centre in Nottingham, a couple more, and I think I'd have lasted 10 minutes, to be honest. So yeah, I feel very lucky, very grateful. I saw to Artabanda and Jinuaja in Nottingham, all the guys on the ordination team. There's no one on the ordination team that I sort of feel at all unsure about. I feel totally confident with every one of them, which is, and the guys at Padmaloka as well. I feel just so confident and happy to be here, to be in the community at Padmaloka. And I really feel that, if it wasn't for these individuals, well, there'd be no order. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't be practicing. So I'll just finish with that. I suppose I feel more and more. Oh gosh, there's so many things to say. I feel more and more that it's sort of, it's the individuals within the order that make up the order that keep me practicing, that keep me happy in my practice, that keep me engaged with my practice. So little of it, I'm not doing myself down here, so little of it is to do with my own efforts. I was really clear on the winter retreat here, the beginning of this year, end of last year, that I felt so contained by what we're doing here. There was a real intensity of practice going on. And I noticed that when I sort of went after the winter retreat, I think I went back to Nottingham or I went to see my dad, I can't quite remember. But I remember feeling this sort of experience of being held, just sort of these boundaries just blurring a bit. And I started noting how my behaviour started changing. And, I just felt much less keen in my, much less sort of on it in a way in my practice. So I really feel that the conditions that I'm surrounded by here are so important. And it's not the conditions, it's the individuals. It's individuals that have made my Dharma life work with a little bit of input from me. But it's, I think, I can fairly safely say I've mostly sort of glided on, you know, the wind or in the slipstream of others' efforts. And I don't feel I'm sort of being lazy or something like that by saying that, but I really do feel that it's other people with a little bit of effort for me that have made my sort of order life what it is. Okay, that'll do. Thank you.